last time. Okay, so that's our conjecture about why it looks the way it does. But needless to say, this is the kind of thing that can give, I mean, this gives scholars careers, you know? The point where you've got a text with three different languages and where do they come from? Oh my word, you know, you can have a whole warehouse of scholars working on that. I'd like to, at the risk of making him a little hobby horse here, I'd like to beat up on Samuel Rolls-Driver a little bit more. And now I'm referring to the opening part of Daniel, where we are told that of the captives, some of these young men are taken and schooled in the way of the Chaldeans. And here we go. In a series of objections against this being written in the 5th century, in the 6th century, during the time of the captivity, here's an objection that Samuel Rolls-Driver raises. Other indications adduced to show that the book of Daniel is not the work of a contemporary are such as the following. The improbability that Daniel and his companions, all strict Jews, should have suffered themselves to be initiated in the superstitious arts of the wise men, verse 14, or that he should have accepted as their president by the wise men themselves, chapter 1, then chapter 2, verse 13. The improbability that Nebuchadnezzar should hold all the wise men of Babylon, including Daniel's three companions, responsible for the failure of some, condemn them to death before their skill had even been tried. Okay, so let's take that first objection. If these are observant Hebrews, what are they doing being schooled in this knowledge of the, you know, the Babylonians? Well, but didn't we have this before in the book of Exodus? You're told in chapter, it's chapter 3 of Exodus, that Moses, who's growing up in the Egyptian court, was schooled in the ways of the Egyptians. And remember, when you're talking about education in the ancient world, there is no such thing as non-religious education. It doesn't exist. Education always involves things that we would recognize as literary, things that would look sort of scientific, and things that would be religious. Okay, so it's no more improbable that these boys would be formed in a Chaldean education than Moses would have been formed by an Egyptian education. And please remember, if you're going to have somebody who's educated, at this point, the Hebrew people don't have a kind of intellectual culture of their own. At this point, what the Hebrew people have is they have a body, they have the scriptures, and they have a body of commentary on that, and they have a body of law by which they apply that to their lives. But in the sense of what we would call literature or science sort of on its own, no, Hebrew people are dependent on folks around them. If you're looking for that sort of thing at this point in history, that's Egypt and Babylon. They're the ones who have secular literature, or at least literature that's not, you know, distinctly looked at as revelation necessarily. And they're the ones who also have a body of something that looks like scientific knowledge. So astronomy. When you look at Egypt, when you look at Babylon, these are folks who have centuries of astronomical observation. They actually chart things out and they work out calendars, right? All those early forms of calendars and stuff like that. They're all from Egypt and Babylon. And the Greeks, when they start putting together sciences like geometry and astronomy, they are building on what it is that they get from Egypt and Babylon. They're building on that. They're not doing that from scratch. By the way, there are authors out there. I think of this when I was at Xavier. Xavier is a black Catholic university. And there was a book that people were buzzing about called Black Athena. And basically, the thesis was that the Greeks stole all this great intellectual work from Egypt and from Africa and called it their own. You know, so that we lionize the Greeks and we lionize their intellectual achievements. They stole them from black folk. right? They stole them from black people in Africa. And when you read someone like Plato and you read Aristotle and you read it, they openly talk about using these things from Egypt. They aren't silent about it. If anything, the Greeks were awed by Egypt. They were awed by this place that it had a civil. Remember, at the time that someone like Aristotle is writing in the 300s or Plato around the same time, Egypt has been a civilization humming along for 3,000 years. They felt like, in fact, they tell you this, they feel like children in the face of Egypt. Okay? But they take things from Egypt and develop them in a way that the Egyptians did not. The Egyptians had all sorts of geometrical formulas. They didn't work out demonstrations. You can't find like a book of proofs from Egypt. What you find are books of formulas that allow them to calculate land and survey land. But what the Greeks would do is they would take all of those formulas and turn them into, hey, given this, you can prove this. Step one, step two, step three. So they took these from, but they developed them in ways that it never occurred to the Egyptians to do. So when you are having these Hebrew boys being educated, to have an education means that you are necessarily exposing yourself to this religious culture that's not your own. That Moses would have done that. Now, of course, the objection of Moses is, well, but Moses wasn't growing up as an observant Hebrew, right? Aren't these boys somehow observant Hebrews? Well, remember, we're pretty early on it becomes clear that they have a great deal of faith and they're loyal. Remember the whole incident with the dietary laws. They're not going to go into the dietary laws. We don't know how long that was going on. We don't know that, in other words, did they make distinctions in terms of what was being offered to them, that this is acceptable, this does not go against our religion, this does, right? In other words, they don't simply throw it all out. There are things which these people have to tell us which are useful to know. So what would I give as an example of that? You know, read Augustine's Confessions. When Augustine is getting educated, and remember, he's sent to his school by his devout mother, right? His mother is a devout Catholic, but she sends him to a pagan school because that's the only schools there are. There aren't Catholic schools. There aren't religious schools. And in the, you know, in the world of the Hebrews, there aren't Hebrew schools or that sort of thing, right? So to be educated necessarily meant that you were exposing to, and to some degree, risking the, you know, contamination of these alien religions. And yet the proof is in the pudding, right? Evidently, they were able to learn from this. They were able to, and remember, you're told that they were learned in the letters and the writings. That's, I said this last time, literacy is a big deal. At this point in history, literacy is something that we just think of like anybody who just graduates from, you know, grade school is literate. But remember how tiny, tiny the number of people who would have been able to read and write were. You know, at this point in history, what are you talking about? 2% of the population? 1% of the population? So most of religious history, I mean, it's only in recent years that we have a system of education where the religion and the secular learning are sort of united in a kind of common view of the truth. For certainly the time of these Hebrew children, and then certainly early Christianity, to be an educated person meant that you were going to expose yourself to a pagan outlook, and that you had to sort out the good stuff from the bad stuff. You know, maybe in that sense, these people are more of a model to our own time. You know, especially as you send your kids to college. I mean, you know, what you have here is a kind of, you know, in the school is a kind of union of faith and secular learning, but that is not common. That is not common. And so chances are after this place, they have to find a place where either they're going to choose one of these rare places where it is united, or they're going to have to work that out. They're going to have to sit there and make the judgment about which part of the secular learning is helping me and which part of this I sort of push away or ignore or tune out. Not entirely easy to do when you're 18, I might add. Okay. So I don't think my response to Driver here is I don't think the fact that these Hebrew boys are being formed in the Babylonians impossible or improbable in light of the fact that we have the example of Moses earlier, and that for most of history, to be godly and to be educated were things that were in conflict. And that these boys had this education and maintained their purity, that's the proof's in the pudding. You see something in this book that you also see in the book of the Maccabees, this emphasis on the dietary laws. Right? In earlier books of the Bible, there are dietary laws, but they aren't emphasized the same way. And here, there's almost a kind of vindication of them, isn't there? That by remaining true to the dietary laws, they actually look stronger and healthier and better. And I don't think the claim here is that, see, a vegetable diet is really good for you. You eat meat, you're going to look pale and wan. And no, it's that by remaining pure in their observance of their Judaism, God graces them in certain ways. Okay, so this isn't just the pulse diet plan, you know, be shinier, happier, stronger than the other boys in the in the Babylonian school, eat more pulse, eat more beans. The idea here is that by remaining faithful to the laws, God graced them, God blessed them in certain ways. Remember that eating meat, it isn't the meat itself, is that meat was always connected with sacrifice. Remember, these are not people who just go to Cubs, go to the meat market and pull packages of meat and put them in their cart. Eating meat always meant that the animal was sacrificed to the gods. Right? Read it in the Iliad, read it in the Odyssey. Nobody just kills an animal. You don't do that. You kill the animal. There's some part of the animal that's burnt to Poseidon or Zeus or whoever. There's some part of the animal you take for yourself. Before you eat, libations are poured from your wine. You know, just glug, 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 right? That's why if you sit down to a meal and you don't give thanks to God, you're worse than pagans. I mean, pagans give thanks to their phony gods before they eat. And the idea with killing the animal and offering part of it, you were recognizing that that animal was a gift to you from the gods. So you couldn't just kill the animal and chow down on it. You had to dedicate part of that animal to the gods. And in fact, there are circumstances in which you simply gave up the whole animal. Right? That's what a holocaust is. Holos, the whole, kostos, burn. You burnt the whole animal. You gave up the whole animal. And you can imagine in an agrarian society how hard that would have been, that you are simply going to burn up the whole animal. I mean, think if you just had to sacrifice that cowboy steak that you had on your plate. I'm giving this to the gods. Okay? Let alone that you're somehow consuming the whole animal.
I'm just beautiful right now with all the furry, the cold. Have you seen cows right now? They're beautiful.
Oh, I have not. I have not. Get out and see that. Stop just hiding in your houses and turning up the thermostat. Get out and see the cows. Finally, I'll just start this, but we'll maybe we can spend more time on it next week. The dream of Nebuchadnezzar. Remember that his demand is not just that they interpret the dream, you've got to tell me what I dreamed. Okay? And one of the things that I cover with sophomores when we read the Screwtape letters, the issue comes up, can the devil read your mind? And the answer is no. The only person who can read your mind and heart is the one who made you. In other words, to know someone like that, you'd have to know them from the inside. And Angels and devils, they don't know you from the inside. They experience you on the outside just like human beings do. Now, obviously they can read a lot from the outside, you know. So these are beings that can track your blood pressure, pulse, breath, degree you're sweating, blushing, turning white, right? So they can infer certain things from body language just like we can. And it's true, there are people that you know them well enough, you know, maybe you've known them all your life, that really you can look at them and say, I know what you're thinking, right? Boom, you just know. But you know that from long association on the outside. Okay? To know a being from the inside, you have to be its maker. So that angels and devils can't know you that way. They still experience you on the outside. So when Nebuchadnezzar demands, you got to tell me my dream, he's unwittingly saying, you essentially have to have a revelation from God. He doesn't realize that that's what he's asking. But only God could know him from the inside. And so that's why when he gives this decree, by the way, Driver finds it improbable that Nebuchadnezzar would simply kill all of his wise men and sorcerers. Really? You know, Eastern imperialist tyrant who has kind of total control and total power. When you read people like Herodotus as a Greek writing about the East, the thing that strikes him in his day, Herodotus' day, he was talking about the Persian Empire. And he says, you know, Greeks, we are ruled by law. We are ruled by nomos. We're ruled by law. We're not just ruled by human beings. When you look at Persia, they are ruled by a man. There's some man that decrees things, and whatever he decrees, you know, that's what they follow. But for us, we are always ruled by law. So there's a law of Sparta, there's a law of Athens, there's a law of Corinth, and that's what we follow. So to them, That's what a Greek meant by being free. Being free didn't mean you get to do whatever you want. Free meant, I'm not being bossed around by other men. We are all bound to follow a law. Whereas when they looked at Persia, to them it was masters and slaves. Because they have no law. They are people for whom the emperor or the, or various governors have kind of absolute rule. So, you know, it's worth looking for examples in his rule in terms of what we know from secular history about what he commanded or didn't command. But that you could have somebody give that fierce a degree in ancient Babylon, I just don't, on the face of it, see that there's something that improbable. So, next time we'll talk a little bit more about the dream, and we'll go into, is it 3 and 4? It's just 3. And 3 is particularly rich because that's the canticle of the three young men in the fiery furnace. So we'll focus on that. Very good.
Thank you. Yep.
Hold on just a second.